little something between you and me. Don't cost you nothing, this one's for free.
Initially, we will use a tool that I've shared with you, which is called the Absolute CVD Risk Benefit Calculator. And that allows you and I to get a better feel for what your current risks, if we do nothing, are going forward. And it gives us a better feel for things in the first instance. It's a really useful, powerful tool to let you be in the driving seat to know what could be available going forward. And then I'm also going to take you through a tool that we're developing that we'll in future be using in combination with the Absolute CVD Risk Benefit Calculator to highlight the pros and cons of different options that you could use to treat your own blood pressure that will have an influence on your overall risk of heart attacks and strokes going forward. So CVD stands for cardiovascular disease. Yep. Now, as things stand, if I'm not mistaken, aside from having high blood pressure and having polycystic kidney disease, so a version of a chronic long-standing kidney disease, you don't have any blood vessel problems. You don't have angina. You don't have stroke disease. You don't have narrowing of any blood vessels. So peripheral vascular disease, that's helpful to know from the outset. So we can use this tool that we've got on the internet. So this is a Canadian production. So James McCormick, based in Vancouver, has been the architect of this tool. And it's based on all the studies that have been done, which demonstrate benefit and show how patients can reduce their individual risks of heart attacks and strokes by following advice and guidance that we can offer. So it's a tool that's designed to help you and I as patient and clinician team together to try and figure out together what your priorities should be going forward. So the bottom line is that it's there, first of all, to inform you what your current risk is. And once you know what your current risk is, I can then put to you what the options are of things that might potentially help you bring your risk of heart attacks and strokes and angina and blood vessel problems down and individualize those choices to you. And then we can talk about what's doable for you, what's realistic, what you're up for, basically. So I'm just going to take you through your individual risk at the moment, briefly. I've already asked you to do a bit of homework, so thank you for doing that. Hopefully in front of us, we've both got the same tool and we've both got an opportunity to use that together. So for other people that are listening to this podcast looking for the same tool, it is crucial that you get the right tool and use it in the right way. So I'm just going to share with that. So if you go on to your browser and you look for this, you're looking for the Absolute CVD Risk Benefit Calculator, and you'll
just go on the internet.
So you go onto the internet and use your search engine to look for the Absolute CVD Risk Benefit Calculator. Now you'll have a couple of options. There is an Australian version. There's a Canadian version. The one that we want is the one that was produced in Canada by an organization called Best Science. So bestscience.com. And then you'll have the Absolute CVD Risk Benefit Calculator. Click on that. And then when you get to the page on the website that you need, you'll also need to press on QRisk 2 at the top of that page, because that will take you to the data that's relevant to you, because we're working in the UK and we're making it relevant to people from the United Kingdom, from Britain, so that numbers count for them. All right. And I've gone ahead and put your numbers into this calculator already, but just to emphasize those numbers, you're going to put your age in, which is
69. Yes, our age is 69.
Yeah. You put your gender, which is male.
Yep.
Ethnicity, which is white.
Right. Non-smoker.
Never had diabetes.
Oh, blood pressure. What you see, we said 136, didn't we? We'll start working off.
Okay, I've got 134, but 136. Is that the most recent one for you?
Yeah, I think that's what we said. 136. Okay. That's what we said yesterday.
You're already on blood pressure treatment, aren't you?
Yeah, click that.
Good. So click that you're already on blood pressure treatment.
What's the next one, Doctor?
So your cholesterol number, you're already on a cholesterol tablet. So that's a bit artificial in terms of the benefits and the risk. And we're not really going to be highlighting the benefits to you of statins because we've already had this conversation before.
Yeah.
We made a decision about statins and it was based on a previous level of your cholesterol. All I have in your records currently is an old cholesterol number because we made a decision that you're going to take a statin and then we weren't going to measure your cholesterol number because it was all about protecting you and we weren't worried about the numbers afterwards. So that's a sensible choice for you.
Oh, correct. Yep.
So your cholesterol number before treatment was 4.3, but your healthy cholesterol number was 1.2.
The total cholesterol, 4.3?
Yeah. And HDL cholesterol, which is your healthy cholesterol, was 1.2.
Right, done that. Family history of CVD.
You don't have a family history of anybody in your family who's a first-degree relative, so a sibling or a parent who has had a heart attack or angina before the age of 60, so we put no for that. But you do have a problem with your kidneys. So you've got leaky kidneys, you've got polycystic kidney disease. So that's relevant. So we're clicking that one. You don't have a rhythm problem with your heart, so you don't have atrial fibrillation. You don't have rheumatoid arthritis. We've put your height and weight in. We used centimeters for that, but there is an option on using imperial measures for that. So 166 centimeters and 80 kilograms for your weight.
Okay.
Lovely. Now, on the right-hand side now, so if you're using a big screen, if you've got a computer, a PC or a Mac, you should be able to visualize now your future risk of heart attacks or strokes in the next 10 years. And we look at a 10-year period, that's your risk period, and we look at 100 people just like you that have got your same risk factors. So the risk factors we've just put in, we're using QRIS2 data. That's important that you've clicked on the QRIS2 button at the top. But on the right, we've now got 100 people. Now, if we did nothing for you going forward, and clearly we're going to do a few things. You've already started to do a few things. So we're going to summarize those in a minute. But on the right-hand side, we then have these happy smiling faces and the sad faces. The happy smiling faces are the ones that don't have a problem going forward. Those are the blue faces. Blue faces are the ones that will have a happy outcome. And unfortunately, those red faces will have a less than happy outcome. They may die of a heart attack or stroke. They may have a heart attack and live. They may suffer with angina. So all of those are possibilities. And they may also have blood vessel damage. So they may have peripheral vascular disease. But in the UK, we're really looking at heart attacks and strokes. So those are the main things that we're looking at in the UK. So currently, if you and I did nothing, and that's including not taking the statin, what would happen is out of 100 blokes like you, we would find that 29 of them would go on to have a heart attack or a stroke in the next 10 years. Okay. Is that clear so far?
It's clear, yeah.
But that's clearly not what we're going to do. And I want to share with you what you can do that will influence that risk going forward of heart attacks and strokes. Yes. Now, you've already had a conversation with me previously, and you and I have come to a shared decision that you wanted to take a statin. And we've got you currently on a statin called atorvastatin at 20 milligrams. Now, 20 milligrams is a kind of a middle dose of atorvastatin. And you and I might come to a decision going forward that you'd be comfortable to increase the dose of that to give you more benefit. So, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to say that at 20 milligrams, it's a relatively moderate dose of a statin. So we're going to click on the button in the middle there. So we, in the middle column here, we have a intervention column, if you like. So things that you and I can do together to work on your risk and to protect your heart and to protect your blood vessels. Yeah. If we click on any intervention, we can only click on one intervention at a time. So if we click on that intervention that you've chosen already, which is a low to moderate intensity of statin, you click on it and what happens?
I've got 22 now.
Okay. So we have found...
We're going down seven. We're going from 29 to 22 people.
Perfect. Okay. So in the colours, we now have different new colors that demonstrates that by taking a statin, you're protecting yourself, and we're saving 7 men like you from having a heart attack or angina over the course of the next 10 years by you taking that dose of a statin. So we've already got the blue smiley faces that are happy and don't have an event during that period of time, no matter what we do. But now, because we've chosen an option for you, or you've chosen an option with my support, we find that we protect 7 people from having a heart attack or a stroke in the next 10 years by you taking that dose of a statin. If you were to make a different decision and say, well, I'm comfortable because I've had no side effects with taking that moderate dose of a statin, I want to take a high dose of a statin, and I wouldn't expect to have any problems with doing that, what would happen? If you scroll down
the slide,
if you
click high intensity,
exactly, yeah. What happens there?
Now down to 19. So we'll see if we've gone from 29, we'll see 10 people now.
Yeah, absolutely. So the relative benefit is 35% for you being on a high intensity statin. The relative benefit for a low intensity or a moderate intensity statin is 25%. But because your risk is quite high, then your benefits are quite high off being on a high dose statin. So it's probably worth your while to change over to a high intensity statin, because it's easy to do and you're not particularly likely to have side effects or problems. I would like to signpost listeners to an Inside Health podcast that was published this month, January 2021. And it talks about the study that was done in 2020 looking at the nocebo effect of statins, or any medication for that matter. And it was a really interesting study. The bottom line of that study just demonstrates that you're just as likely to have soreness of your muscles or joints taking a statin as you are taking a placebo tablet. So that's called the nocebo study, and it's really worthwhile taking a listen to, so that you can understand that statins are not particularly likely to cause side effects in themselves. It's just often the belief and expectation that statins are going to cause you to have side effects that causes you potentially to have more in the way of side effects when you're taking a statin than other tablets, for example. Have you come across that at all?
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to come back to that decision about statins shortly, but the bottom line is that you potentially stand to get more benefit from being on a high-intensity statin. So you're currently, with taking a moderate-intensity statin, getting a 7-person benefit over 10 years, and you potentially could get a 10-person benefit in 10 years if you chose to go to a high-intensity statin. So that might be something to keep on the table, something that at the end of this discussion that you might want to say, do you know, Dr. Birrell, I think that's a priority for me. Let's do that sometime.
Can I ask one question, Doctor?
Of course you can.
I noticed on the increase in the statin to the moderate, there was no mention of kidney damage, but on the high one, there is mention of kidney damage. Would that be a problem with me having polycystic kidneys?
I wouldn't expect so, but that's something that potentially we should be watching out for. So the potential harms for intervention, you're quite right to say that if you're on a high dose of statin, it is highlighted as being a potential risk, and it's something that we should be keeping an eye on. It would be a reasonable decision to make, bearing in mind that we would have to treat 10,000 people with a high-intensity statin for one person to be harmed. So the risks are very small, but it's something that we could monitor, and we could start you on the high-dose statin if you chose to, and then monitor what happens to your kidney function and make sure it doesn't deteriorate significantly with that. But I wouldn't expect that you'll have a problem. It's pretty rare. So 1 in 10,000 people would have a significant problem with their kidney function deteriorating. So the risks are very small. Okay. If it's okay with you, we can only choose one intervention at a time. So we're going to pretend that you're not on a statin for the moment, just for the sake of illustrating the potential benefits of every intervention that you could take. And we're going to highlight after this discussion the things that you could do, or we could do as a team together, to work on your blood pressure. Because the reason that we're having this discussion is to help you with your blood pressure. And a lot of people think that blood pressure is really important. And I want to try and emphasize how important blood pressure can be and why we focus on blood pressure, but also to remind you and me and the listening public that blood pressure is just a marker. So you can't tell that you've got high blood pressure unless you measure it. Neither can I. And in itself, your blood pressure being high doesn't mean that you're going to go on to have a heart attack or a stroke. It just means that your risk is higher of having a heart attack or stroke. So the bottom line is that you and I as a team should be trying to do everything we can to reduce your risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. But a lot of the things that you and I can do as a team will have a benefit for your blood pressure without the blood pressure being the thing that's the most important thing that we're looking for. So all the things that we can do are proven to benefit to a degree. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So looking at that column of interventions, things that you can do or we can do together, what have you already done? What would you like to just make comments about?
Well, I do exercise. I get me 10,000 steps in a day.
Great.
Most days. I do try and eat sensibly now. For all, I am overweight. I know I'm overweight. I don't take supplements. I was taking vitamin D until I read that with kidney problems you maybe shouldn't, so I stopped taking vitamin D. So that's something I was going to ask you about, but I should have kept all of vitamin D. I have BP meds. I do take statins as there. The rest of them, I don't smoke. I do have a drink. I drink mostly, I'll think about 20 to 25 units a week, but I would drink 2% alcohol. Apart from that's it, really.
Lovely. That's really helpful. And that gives us things to talk about for the benefit of other people as well as the benefit of you. In terms of vitamin D, I think that it's important that you take the recommended dose of vitamin D, and that's not going to be available to you through sunlight in the UK at this time of year. So I think you would be safe to be taking 1,000 international units of vitamin D on a daily basis.
And that
is healthy for your bones. We don't understand fully what the other benefits are in terms of vitamin D status, but it seems to be important where it comes to our immune function. We don't know if it has an influence on how likely we are to be poorly if we contract the COVID virus. So I think that the precautionary principle is that it's safe, it's cheap, cost effective, and readily available. So 1,000 international units a day, it seems sensible to carry on taking. So just to take each of these buttons in turn, in terms of your relative benefit and your absolute benefit. So I'm just going to emphasize these terms again. Is this something you've come across before, relative benefit and absolute benefit?
No.
Okay. So the relative benefit, if we were to take 100 people, so we've suggested for you, the statin that you're taking gives you a 25% relative benefit, which means that for 100 people who have 100% risk in the next 10 years of having a heart attack, if you give them a statin, you'll protect 25% of people.
Yeah.
But if your personal risk of having a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years was 10% rather than 100%, your absolute benefit would only be 2.5% rather than 25%. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So there's a crucial difference between relative benefit and absolute benefit. So when we're trying to individualize things to help you to make a choice about what you want to do, you want to know what the absolute benefit is. The fact that I'm telling you that there's a 25% benefit doesn't mean much to you if your risk is very low. But if your risk is very high, then it's really important for us to kind of fully inform you of how much benefit you would get. You mentioned physical activity. You're already achieving 10,000 steps per day.
Most days, yes.
Which is a worthwhile target to be aiming for. And I very much encourage other people to consider using an app on their phone that would help them monitor how many steps they're taking a day. If people don't have a smartphone, there's the possibility of using a pedometer. The research that's been done into how much exercise that you should be taking would suggest that you will get all of these health benefits, the benefits of a 25% relative risk reduction. So if we click on that button there, we find that exercise is just as good as taking a moderate or a low dose statin. So you get just as much benefit in terms of protecting your heart, protecting yourself from strokes as well, by taking regular exercise. And what that means in terms of regular exercise is that you take either moderate activity, so that would be 90 to 150 minutes per week, or 75 minutes of vigorous activity, which could be running, biking or swimming, or a mixture of the two of those. So that's what that means. But I think that if you're aiming for 10,000 steps per day, that's realistic for most people and achievable and easy to monitor. So using a pedometer or using an app on your phone is a really good way of keeping yourself on task and targeting how much exercise you're doing. So you're probably getting that 25% benefit already. Now, you've mentioned that you're already on a statin. You've also mentioned that you're taking regular exercise. I don't know if I add both of those together that you're going to get 25% benefit, both of those. So I can't say that you're going to get 50% benefit, but you're getting more benefit than 25% by taking both of those interventions. Does that make sense as well? Yeah.
That makes sense, yes.
Out of those other possibilities, what else might grab you as being doable for you?
Well, I definitely need to lose some weight.
Okay. So your current weight is 80 kilograms.
Which is what in real money, doctor?
Ah, okay. That's a really good question. Well, can you tell me what it's been historically with your weight? Because it's not changed enormously, has it?
No, to be honest with you, from my younger days, I was never more than 10 and a half stone. Mm-hmm. I worked in the coal mine for 25 years, so I was very, very happy. I left the coal mine, went to work in the factory as a maintenance technician. I was very, very, very happy. I then had an operation. For my date, I've never had a physical job. I've always had an office job. I've always sat down at the computer. That's why I do try and get me 10,000 steps in. So for my day, from about 2002, I've come up to about, I was thinking about nearly 13 stone, which I think is about a stone and a half too heavy.
Yeah.
My size.
It is a bit confusing comparing kilograms and stones because people are speaking different languages. And I think it's helpful for you to use a tool that will help you to calculate your body mass index and for you to know what that body mass index means and how relevant it is to your health going forward. So I'm creating materials on my website. So this is the patient center within realgeneralpractice.org. So if people at the moment go to realgeneralpractice.org, use the patient link and then click on blood pressure, it'll bring them to a tool that will help you to figure out what actions and options that you and I have got as a patient clinician team to manage your blood pressure and your weight. So we're going to talk a little bit about what the body mass index means. Have you come across that term before?
Yes, I have, yes.
So you can use the NHS tool as well. So the NHS have a very good calculator that will allow you to work out what a healthy weight is for you. So if you go to the www.nhs.uk and then /live-well/healthy-weight/BMI-calculator. Basically, the NHS calculator will allow you to work out what your a healthy BMI is. In short, your BMI currently is higher than you and I would like it to be, and it will be having an influence upon your blood pressure. And as a consequence of that, it will also be having an influence upon your future risk of heart attacks or strokes. But your BMI is 29, so that doesn't make you officially obese, but it makes you overweight. And there is quite a lot of evidence that would suggest that if you're overweight and your body mass index is over 27, that if you reduce your body mass index back towards 27 and perhaps a little bit lower than that, every kilo that you reduce will reduce your blood pressure and also reduce your future risk of heart attacks and strokes. we would expect a blood pressure reduction of about 1 point, 1 millimeter of mercury point per kilo that you lose. So you might want to consider reducing your weight down towards a body mass index of 27. And the NHS calculator will allow you to figure out how much weight you need to lose to get towards that.
Yep.
Now, there are different ways of achieving that. And it might be, if you're interested, that we could go into some more depth about that at some stage. If we're just going to highlight again some of the other options that we've talked about before. So you mentioned your weight. We don't have weight per se recorded in here. And weight is certainly worthwhile talking about. So we're going to come back to that. But at the moment, if we look at the tool that we've got in front of us, which is the Absolute CVD Risk Benefit Calculator, we've already clicked on physical activity. We've already clicked on statins. We've talked a little bit about weight. How do you think that you might achieve a better weight balance? How do you think you might be able to achieve reducing your weight a little bit?
I think with what I eat, what my diet is, diet and exercise.
Yeah. Okay. Have you been successful in the past in changing what you eat and your activity levels to such an extent that you've actually managed to have impact upon your weight?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My weight goes down. I sometimes go down to, might leave, down to 12 and a half stone, and then it comes back up again. It comes down again, comes back again. The only good thing is it very rarely goes above the weight I am now. Very, very rarely. And it soon comes off. But I think diet's the main thing. But I still think I eat fruit, eat vegetables. Whether it's just the way I am, I don't know.
So just going to ask a little bit more. So I would encourage other people who are listening to this podcast, if they want to know a little bit more or explore some of the options for helping them to manage their weight, they might want to go to our main patient page and then type in how to lose weight and then listen to the podcast that we have and also look at the tool for how to lose weight. And that hopefully will point them in the right direction to get further support from their team at their general practitioners or elsewhere. If we could focus a little bit about what's been successful for you, because you know that changing your diet and your activity levels works. What's the key thing there? What do you think actually makes more of a difference than anything else when it comes to your diet or your activity levels? What have you noticed really works?
I think a big problem with diet with weight is bread. Mm. I always used to eat a lot of bread from being a child. Always ate bread. Another thing, always finish meals. Never leave anything on the plate. But I think what you eat and the portion size makes a big difference.
Yeah.
In other words, if somebody put a plate of food down the middle, a small plate, I would eat it. But if somebody come on and put a plate, the same plate of food down on a big plate, I would still eat it.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's all sorts of things that we could talk about related to what you're eating. Where it comes to the evidence of what's the most healthy for your heart, then the Mediterranean diet has the most evidence behind it. But when people are trying to stick to a healthy diet, some people struggle with one version of a diet compared to another version of a diet. And it's just worthwhile emphasizing the diets that we don't recommend and talking about the diets that we do recommend. So I'd like to highlight that the Mediterranean diet has a lot of features in it. It doesn't ask you to skimp on bread, incidentally, but it would encourage you to have grainy bread. So unrefined bread is important. Whole grain versions, seeds are all good. I think portion size is important. There's no question about that. Overeating is not helpful. And that overeating can be fueled by drinking. If you're drinking alcohol, and alcohol in itself has a lot of energy inside of it, it also drives your appetite and can make it difficult for you to eat the right portion size and to eat healthily. So it's really worthwhile highlighting those factors as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, Douglas, you got something you wanted to say?
No, I was just going to say I don't eat much white bread. I normally eat wholemeal.
Yeah.
I do try and cut down on my bread. I do eat a lot of Mediterranean diet stuff, such as fruit, tomatoes, peppers, lettuce, spring onions, such as that. But not every day. Not every day.
We're going to mention the Mediterranean diet, and we're going to compare it with the diet that's probably the least helpful and the one that we would discourage people from going towards, which is the low-fat diet. So the low-fat diet Unfortunately, if you go into a supermarket and you buy something that's got low fat quantity in it, it tends to be high in sugars. A lot of food manufacturers will artificially add in sugars to make things palatable. So you really have to be very cautious when you're going for a low fat diet, because you probably are inadvertently going to end up with something that's got a lot more in the way of refined carbohydrates and sugars to try and make food taste a bit better. So that's possibly why the Mediterranean diet is so much more healthy, and the evidence is so much better for the Mediterranean diet than it is the low fat diet. So the one diet that I would very much discourage people from going towards is the low fat diet. So if we click on the button for the Mediterranean diet and compare it with the low fat diet, you'll find that there's a 30% relative risk reduction. So if your risk was 100% in the next 10 years, we would save 30 people from having a heart attack or a stroke in the next 10 years by changing them from the low fat diet to the Mediterranean diet. But for you, Douglas, what does it say? If you click on that button for Mediterranean diet.
30%.
So 30% protection, 30% relative risk reduction. But for you individually, how many people is that saving? So your original risk was 29. And by encouraging you to change over to a healthier diet, which is the Mediterranean diet compared to the low-fat diet, then we find that we're protecting 9 people. So 9 people get that protection for all 100 people making that change to the diet. So a really worthwhile intervention just to change over to a healthier version of a diet that most people can do. They need to be organized in terms of shopping and having meal plans and having the right recipes ready to be able to make these changes. But it is a doable thing for most people. Any questions related to diet? I'm going to highlight that we're going to come back in a bit more detail and go through in a bit more detail some of the other things that are worthwhile changing. I'm going to highlight very briefly at the moment the alcohol consumption, which is a key thing, because a lot of people that drink more than the recommended amount of alcohol per week will find that their blood pressure goes up as a consequence. And that's something that's very important. So we're going to highlight that. We're going to mention salt, but we're going to come back to talking about salt in a bit more detail a bit later on. We also talked about the things on that list of interventions, the options of things that you could do to try and reduce your risk. You mentioned that you're not a big fan of supplements. And quite rightly, if we click on taking a vitamin supplement or trying omega-3 supplements, if you click on that button, what happens? So interestingly, when you look at it, the relative benefit is 0%, isn't it? So you've got a number at the top of the screen that says...
Yes, zero. It hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed. So the benefit you previously had from taking the Mediterranean diet has gone because we've clicked on a different button. But we've now got all these red faces and pink faces, and they're all still unhappy. And nobody has had any benefit from any changes that you've made. So anything that people are investing in terms of vitamin supplements and omega-3 supplements is not protecting them from heart attacks or strokes or angina. It's a pointless intervention from that point of view. And on the whole, if you've got a good varied diet, Mediterranean diet included in that, then you'll be getting plenty of vitamins. The only supplement that we're recommending generally, particularly in the winter time, is vitamin D. You're already on blood pressure tablets, and your blood pressure control is reasonable but not perfect. But it'd be interesting to explore whether for you, Douglas, if you clicked on having an extra blood pressure tablet, would that make a difference to you, to your risk? Shall we try that together? Yeah.
No benefit.
So no benefit. So your blood pressure is treated to a pretty good target, and there's no evidence that any further improvement in your blood pressure control in terms of tablets is worth your while. But having said that, there are other things that work and also will have an effect on your blood pressure. So losing weight will cause your blood pressure to come down. Do you remember how much your blood pressure would come down with each kilogram that you lose? Yeah, so we'd expect 1 point of blood pressure improvement for every kilogram that you lost, so down to a BMI of 27. Worthwhile keeping your blood pressure under control and making those changes, because those are heart benefit changes that are independent of blood pressure, because your blood pressure is actually okay. Yeah?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So that's a little bit about blood pressure tablets. So I don't think we need to prioritize for you today, a change in your blood pressure tablets. So that was one of the questions before we decided to have this meeting today that we wanted to answer. Was it worthwhile giving you an extra tablet? And it looks like it probably isn't. We've talked about statins. We're going to come back to that later. Is there anything else in that list that might be of interest to you, do you think?
No, we don't smoke.
So all these other options, most of these other options are for people with type 2 diabetes, and you don't have type 2 diabetes, so there's probably no point in clicking on any of these intervention. You don't smoke. You've never smoked. So there's
no reason. Yes, I've been stopped smoking 17 years.
Okay. Interestingly, for an ex-smoker, you have a higher risk, but because you've been an ex-smoker for so long, your risk comes back to normal. So I think it's okay for us to still call you a non-smoker, but the ex-smokers, after they've been ex-smokers for more than 10 years, then their risk is pretty much back to normal. The other thing that just at the very bottom that you might want to click on is aspirin. ASA is the abbreviation they've used. So you click on aspirin for you, and there's a potential small benefit. Now, I know you're not on aspirin at the moment, and for most people who are at low risk, then being off on aspirin probably isn't particularly helpful. But because your risk is relatively high, then you and I may consider aspirin, the pros and cons of aspirin. But the things that we need to rule out are aspirin sensitivity. Now, I noticed from your records that you've got a history of nasal polyps. So people with nasal polyps are more likely to be sensitive to aspirin. Have you ever taken aspirin before?
Yes. I think a long time ago, I think maybe under Dr. Laws, mm-hmm. I think I took aspirin.
Did it cause you any side effects or problems?
No, I don't think so. I think the soluble type I took.
Yeah. Did it make your polyps or your nasal obstruction any worse?
I couldn't say that. It was a long time since. I'm trying to think why we did it. I think it was the first doctor I saw about blood pressure when I was in my 40s because it ran in the family.
Yeah.
And I just had a normal blood pressure check, and he said it was a little bit high. And I started tablets. I started, the Lisinopril, which kept my blood pressure regular and low for a long, long, long time till I had that big problem with it. But I don't think I took aspirin for very long at all.
No. Okay. So just a question about your risk. If we were to put you on aspirin, or you were to decide to take aspirin, it does slightly increase your risk of bleeding from your stomach. You've never had a bleeding ulcer from your stomach or any peptic ulcers, so duodenal ulcers or gastric ulcers. If you're over the age of 75, we'll often offer you something to protect your stomach at the same time as you taking aspirin. Or if you were perceived at being a high risk of bleeding from your stomach, then we might want to give you that protection. So that would be an extra couple of tablets to have to take, and that might be a deal breaker. It might be something that you're not happy to take. But the relative benefits for you of taking aspirin are 15% for you. But the personal benefit is that four people over the course of the next 10 years will get benefit by 100 people like you being on aspirin for 10 years. And that might be a worthwhile benefit, but the risk of bleeding would be approximately two people in 100 would have a big bleed from their gut, bad enough to need treatment.
Four compared to two, is it really, when you think about it?
Yeah.
Four benefit two awards, so it's only two really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think that what you have to say with that is it's difficult to compare a heart attack or a stroke with a bleed. Because if you have a bleed, you can treat a bleed, you can correct for it. If we gave you something to protect your stomach, that's an extra tablet on top of that, but that would also probably bring your risk greatly down, not completely to zero, but to close to that. So if you took aspirin for 10 years, four people would get benefit from taking that aspirin in terms of it protecting them from heart attacks or strokes. And if you took an extra tablet, that would protect those additional two people that would likely have a serious bleed from having that serious bleed. But that's an extra tablet. It's part of your decision-making process, and I'm only here to try and inform you of the potential benefits to you of making that intervention. So there's a benefit. It's not nearly as useful as making a change to your diet, not nearly as useful as exercising regularly. It's a small benefit, but it's a benefit nonetheless.
Yeah.
I'm sensing that you're not ready to make that change to aspirin, but you might be happy to make that change to a higher dose statin.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to draw a line under this part of the discussion because we've pretty much finished using the tool for comparing your absolute cardiovascular disease risk benefit. Yeah.
Yep.
So at this point, would you like just to tell me where about you are in your decision-making process, Douglas?
I think we should be going for the highest statin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should be looking at the diet.
Yeah.
And keeping up with the exercise.
Great. Okay. Let's just summarize that and try and flesh it out a little bit in terms of the detail of how we're going to do that and what we could do. So the first decision was to change you over to a high dose statin. So you're currently on 20 milligrams of atorvastatin, and possibly you might want to go up to 80 milligrams. You could do that in steps via 40 to 80, or you could go straight for 80 and not expect to have any particular problems. What do you think?
Can I just ask one question about one of the statins first, don't I?
Of course you can.
When I first took the statin, I wasn't on atorvastatin, I was on simvastatin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I seem to be able to take them much easier than what I do with these. Is there a difference?
Well, the atorvastatin is more potent for the milligrams that you take. So it's more effective in terms of bringing your cholesterol numbers down. And it also, the evidence behind how beneficial it is to protect you against heart attacks or strokes is better too. It also is easier to take because you don't have to take it on a night time like you used to have to take the simvastatin, and it doesn't interact with so many of your medications. So it's simpler and perhaps safer to take. So I think for most people, it would be a preferred statin, but 10 milligrams of atorvastatin is about equivalent to 40 milligrams of simvastatin in terms of how much benefit you get from it.
Right. So what do you think? Should we go to 40 for a while and see how we take it, then move up again to the 80? Or should we jump straight into 80? Because we always go high, then drop down low, can't you?
You can, absolutely. So if you do find that you have side effects, and the studies that we've highlighted earlier on would suggest that we wouldn't really expect you to have any significant side effects with the low dose, the medium dose, or the high dose. But if you do have side effects, and everybody's individual, you can always drop that back down to the original dose and then go back up to the middle dose if you wanted to, and then see how things go. But don't assume that just because you've changed the tablets that any side effects that you get are actually caused by the tablets. It might just be complete coincidence or an expectation that they're going to cause side effects that's caused you to have the side effect. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it seems reasonable for you to try going up in dose. I'm comfortable for you to try the high one. I'm also comfortable for you to go for the intermediate one first. Which one would you prefer?
Well, we'll go for the high. We'll go for the high.
Okay. You mentioned that you're a little bit anxious about your kidney function test deteriorating on that because there's a 1 in 10,000 risk that it could affect your kidney function. So we should do your kidney function afterwards. So
I don't get a kidney function every 3 months anyway, Doc.
Perfect. So we'll just keep an eye on your kidney function routinely, as we had previously planned to do, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that's fine.
If you are getting side effects with the higher dose statin, get back in touch. We'll make a decision together going forward and decide what you want to do. But we wouldn't really expect you to have a problem. But if you're feeling poorly, stop the medication. Let me know. We can always make a plan of action going forward.
Right. Yep.
That's regarding the statin. The other decision that you were talking about was regarding your diet and working on a healthier version of what you're currently doing. What's doable for you?
To try and get a BMI of 27.
Okay. So you'd like to head for that. Okay. Yep. In that case, I'd like to encourage you, if you're happy to listen to me talking to another guy on my website. So if you go to the patient part of the website and type in how to lose weight, then you can listen to me talking to him about what would work for him. And hopefully that will inspire you to then figure out with my support, and there's also a pros and cons table that goes with that one, that will help you decide with my support what you do next to help you with your weight.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think that tackling your weight will probably have an impact upon this. And the one thing that I would encourage you to do, because one thing that will probably be easier for you is if you would moderate your alcohol intake. So you mentioned before that you're probably consuming about 24, 25 units per week. You would find that achieving your target weight will be a lot easier if you're drinking less than 14 units or less than 10 units per week. Right. In terms of your normal drinking habits, how would you normally consume your 25 units a week?
I normally just drink lager, but I see it's always low alcohol stuff. It's less than 2%.
Good. Okay. Well, it does still have sugars in it.
Oh, yes. But the difference is, if you compare less than 2%, I think it's 50 calories a can or 52 calories a can. Compared to normal lager, 4.8% or 3.8%, which is 120 something calories a can.
Great. Well, I would also emphasize to other people that want to drink that is a good way to play it, to aim for less units of alcohol per week. To aspire for the majority of people to get down to less than 14 units per week is a really good start, and healthier for their body and healthier for their blood pressure too. But also don't forget about the total calories that you're having and the empty calories that you're having in the way of alcohol, that can make a big contribution to your weight as well. So that's really helpful. Okay. If people want to go into more depth about what the healthiest diet for them would be, I would encourage them to at least consider the Mediterranean diet, which is so much healthier than the low-fat diet. But there are other versions of healthy diets that we're going to talk about perhaps in a little bit more detail coming up. But for the time being, just to highlight that there are other healthier options that will allow people to lose weight, include and also target their blood pressure. So the DASH diet is also a worthwhile thing to think about. The FAST diet is one that I often encourage people to follow, because it's a good diet for people that aren't very good at dieting, because they only have to diet.
What diet is your doctor?
The FAST diet, or the 5-2 diet. So it's a good diet for people that aren't very good at dieting. The reason it's good is that it only encourages them to diet 2 days a week. So 2 separate days, and they have to go for low calories on those days. So for men, we would encourage them to be consuming 600 kilocalories a day. For women, it'd be 500 on those days. But the rest of the days, they can eat fairly normally. And the low GI diet is another diet that is regarded as being a healthy option, particularly for people that are prone to becoming diabetic or type 2 diabetic. So if you're overweight, then it's another diet that's worthwhile considering, because it keeps you full for longer. It's healthier probably for your insulin levels, and also for your appetite. So that's another diet that's really worthwhile considering. The evidence is best for the Mediterranean diet as far as your heart is concerned, but all of those diets are worthwhile considering as options for helping you going forward.
Quick question on diets. Mm-hmm. A normal adult would think of taking how many calories a day?
I would be guesstimating on that one. So please don't try and pin me down. I'll have to look it up on Google to find out.
But what would you see? Let's say it was 2,500.
Is that what you've read?
Well, I think I've read that somewhere, 2,500 for a man, yeah.
Okay.
But to lose weight reasonably, what would you have to eat?
So what we suggest on the fast diet is that you consume on your fasting days 600 kilocalories. But to lose weight, you don't want to be losing weight any faster than about a kilogram per week at the most. And most people would say about a pound a week. And the last thing I want to do is to encourage you to be taking up a diet that leaves you hungry all the time. It's okay to acknowledge your hunger and to accept that hunger, but you don't want to be starving yourself for long periods of time, because it makes it unsustainable. So a diet has to be doable long term. Yep. It has to be enjoyable. Myself and my wife at the moment are doing the body plan at the moment, which encourages you to eat very healthily and lots of protein in the diet, and it balances when you have plenty of carbohydrates. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to do as long as you're exercising lots. So I'm finding that because I'm exercising lots, I can eat lots too. And you have to balance that energy requirement, so that if you were down the coal mine again, then you would be able to have a lot more than 2,500 kilocalories in a day. So I don't know what the best is for you with your energy requirements, but I think that you can figure that one out over a long period of time. But you don't want to be starving yourself over a long period of time. You want to be eating what's healthy for you. You want to be avoiding refined carbohydrates, because sugars and refined carbohydrates cause your insulin levels to peak, your glucose levels to peak, and then for you to suddenly crash and get hungry and then need to eat again. And that's not healthy. But you also don't want to be nutritionally inadequate. You need to make sure that you're replacing all your nutritional requirements. Now, I'm not a dietitian. I'm not trained to be able to give you expert advice from that point of view. But in terms of the absolute evidence for the benefits to your heart, then I do know that some diets are better than others. The low-fat diet is the one that's potentially harmful. The Mediterranean diet is comparatively speaking a lot healthier. And there are other diets that theoretically have a lot of merit to them that seem to be very healthy, that we can certainly recommend to help you to manage your weight. But I think that the key is you can pick and choose from those combination of diets what works for you, and you don't always have to stay on the same diet. But as long as you're thinking about balancing your nutritional requirements and your energy requirements, but also expending enough energy to use up the energy that's coming in. So it will change from person to person. So me giving you a value for one person is perhaps not very helpful. I don't want people to ignore the salt intake question as well. Is this something that you've come across? Is this something you're familiar about?
What? Salt intake?
Yeah.
Yeah. So don't use salt.
Okay. You can use salt for taste. And the salt that I would recommend that most people should be having for cooking at home and for adding to their chips, if they're going to be having chips. Incidentally, we shouldn't be having too many chips, but they are going to be having chips. And I love chips, but I don't have them very often. I would always put potassium chloride, low salt, on my chips. And I use that for cooking. So I use it to salt water. I use it for seasoning in all the food that I use. And that's actually healthy. So I think that it's sensible for you to swap out the table salt that you have on your table and in your kitchen for cooking to a low salt, which tastes pretty much the same. And I think most people can't discern the difference, is actually very healthy for you. So
what about sea salt?
So sea salt isn't the right balance. I would go for something that is high in potassium and low in sodium. So you want to have low salt is a brand, but your reduced sodium salt is what I would encourage people to be using. And there's a growing body of evidence that that is a much healthier thing in terms of bringing your blood pressure down and protecting your heart. So certainly something that we should be recommending as a safe swap for your kitchen and for your dining room table as well.
Yeah, yes.
Be cautious about some medications. So soluble medications on the whole have got a lot of sodium in that's not healthy. That will potentially put your blood pressure up. Incidentally, dispersible aspirin is safe and doesn't have that high sodium content. So that's okay to use. There are a lot of foodstuffs that have high potassium content, and they're worthwhile having as well because they're beneficial for your blood pressure, because the body does need a certain amount of potassium. And that potassium will also bring the blood pressure down. So the sort of foodstuffs that you might be thinking about could include spinach, pulses, beans, chicken, avocado. Avocado is very high in energy, but it does have a lot of potassium in it. I think it's part of a good balanced diet is to be using something like that. Do you want to say anything else about diet before we move on to?
No, that's fine. That's fine, Dora. Yeah. No. Quite happy there, yeah.
So we're going to talk a bit more about exercise. You mentioned that you wanted to carry on with your healthy activity levels. I think that what you're doing at the moment is great. I want to emphasize to people listening that during our various lockdown experiences, that Boris has been painting a very black and white position on you must not go out. And I've been very anxious that this would deter people from being as active as they should be. I think people during this dangerous time have rightly needed to stay away from each other, keep a good social distance. But I think that keeping them inside has not necessarily been the way to achieve that. And I would encourage them to keep that 10,000 steps up, or to keep going with any physical activity that would also be safe for them as well. So being outside, cycling, outside walking, it is also safe as long as you're not actually in close proximity with other people. And I think what you're already doing sounds great. If you were able to do more, I mean, you're physically fit, aren't you?
Yeah, we do more some days.
Yeah.
Some days we can walk 2 or 3 miles.
Great. So the more you do that, the better you'll feel. And also you'll probably find that that has a consequence in terms of your weight. So you're absolutely right. You want to try to balance what you're eating for what your exercise levels are, and just keep an eye on your weight and make sure that you. So most people find that the weight tends to drift year on year, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. People are a bit more conscious about their calorie intake and how healthy their food is. That can often make a huge difference. And you clearly can do. You know how to alter that balance from experience. But alcohol is a part of that picture as well. Today, I'll change your prescription to atorvastatin 80. You're going to have a blood test repeated again as planned every 3 months.
I think that's due February, Doctor, I think.
So we'll do that in February, and then every 3 months we'll keep an eye on that. And if your kidney function is deteriorating significantly, you and I are going to need another conversation. If you have any side effects or problems with taking a different dose of statin, you can get back in touch with me and we'll have a conversation about what we do next.
In the meantime, we'll have a think about the aspirin.
Great. Yeah, and have a ponder about what you want to do about the aspirin, because as I say, there's a small benefit from being on aspirin in terms of protecting you from heart attacks or strokes, but there's a small increased risk of bleeding. And as you get older, and if you're taking it for a long period of time, there is a small risk that smaller risk of bleeding may not be something you'd be happy about, but it is potentially treatable. But we could protect against that increased risk by giving you something to protect your stomach. But then again, that stomach protection has side effects and small risks as well. So it's all a matter of balancing that up and trying to figure out between us as a team what you want to do.
Let's hear it for our GP. Skills improving, risk removing, no confusing.